Major Han, Reel 55. You were saying about an exercise.
Yes, that was much later. It was when I was with the 12th Lancers. And I was doing umpire. It was in down in southern Germany. And it was the German army was involved. Quite a big exercise. And I was umpiring. And B squadron of our regiment, I was in their area. And they were going some particular direction, and in front of them was this potato field, and there were some pickers there, you know, was ready for picking or digging, and the squadron of tanks came up, went straight through it. I mean, to me, as a farmer or that sort of thing, you know, I was horrified, but. As a soldier, that was what would happen. And of course, they went straight through. There's a certain amount of the crops would have been saved, obviously, but you get 12 tanks or 15 tanks going abreast across the field, it's bound to do a tremendous amount of damage. But of course, that was all paid for by the German government.
Yeah, I think you said that you saw some German tanks. Were these German tanks that went across that field, or some of ours?
They were all ours that went across, and I think the Germans were the opposition, and they would be in their dug-in positions. And I remember once there was, I'm not sure whether they had been Tiger tanks then or Panther.
Those were wartime German tanks, weren't they? Tigers
the
and Panthers.
The Leopard.
The Leopard.
That's right, they were Leopard tanks. And I was in this particular area, about six tanks, all with their guns in different directions, and they were all shooting. And there was this is on the main road, and there was some poor little chappy in a Volkswagen car who was, you know, right underneath them. He must have been terrified of these things, but they. That was it. They were doing their battle and that. But these people just have to get out of the way. It was that mentality, really. And I think the German civilians accepted it. You know, they probably might have been used to it during the war, but they certainly didn't seem to complain. So, but this was going on much, much later, not the period when I was with the 4th Lancers.
Roughly what proportion of the 4th Hussars do you think were regulars at this stage, and what proportion would be conscripts?
We have the conscription, didn't we? I should say at least 60% were regulars. At least. Certainly, most of the NCOs, senior NCOs, were all regulars and warrant officers. And there were probably, might have been a couple of officers per squadron who were short service, you know, from 3 years or whatever. But that, it was good with the conscripts, really, because you had a tremendous amount of talent. No matter what you want to do, if you want to run a concert party, or if you want to get a cricket match going, or football, or whatever, you had all this talent there. And no matter what it was, you'd find two or three stars in that particular field, which was great.
It's been often been said by critics of national service that the fact they came in and out disrupted the training cycle. Did you find that happened, or were there ways of overcoming those difficulties?
I don't think it mattered a great deal, because the nucleus of a regiment was there. All the NCOs, and you might get a new gunner in your one of your tanks, or you might get a new driver. So you might get two or three in a troop, but they would soon be trained out. And it didn't affect a great deal the efficiency of the troop. I don't know what it was like in infantry regiments, but certainly in the cavalry regiments, I don't think it mattered a great deal. I know it probably caused a lot more work, training, administration, and that sort of thing. But we soon found that the conscripts who came soon settled in and got into the spirit of the regiment and its troop. And most of them, when they left, were sorry to leave. Some of them say, well, it took a lot out of their life, that training that they were going to do for the first civil life. But they say it was an experience they were glad they had.
Did you find any of them decided to become regulars, to enlist and carry on in the army?
We got one or two who would, but on the whole, the ones who had their careers planned out, they want to get out and get on with it. But I think on the whole, they enjoyed it, and I say that it was great, really, because you had a regiment which was always up to strength anyway.
Did you find that the conscripts tended to go into certain particular jobs in the regiment, or did they do everything like in the same way as the regulars would, given that they were all private soldier level?
Well, they would come in and they would be trained in a particular thing. See, they would then be either a driver, a gunner, or operator, a vehicle driver, probably a cook. That or might get one or two clerks. We could always get some good clerks, and so they used to be sorted out and then sort of put to the job which they would be more suited to.
Who actually decided on that? Was that done by the adjutant or by some other person?
Well, normally sort of a team of people would sort of look, and sort of say, well, ask the man, what do you feel on? What do you like to do? Are you... you drive, you got a license, and they'd probably tell you what their interests were, and you try them out on them, and then put them in a course, for about 3 months, and bring them up to a good standard, and then they'd be their job. Once they were fitted in the troop, they were happy.
How long did they stay with you normally?
I think it was about 2 years. I think it was a 2 year. Then they reduced it to 18 months, did they not? I think it was 2 years to start with.
What sort of war role were you training for when you were going out on the field exercises and so on?
I think the main threat then was the Russians, wasn't it? So all your exercises were sort of orientated that way.
Do you remember if the main slant of the training was towards offensive operations or defensive?
I think it was mainly defensive. And we used to run the exercise. There'd be, two or three regiments as it would be the blue, and another two or three would be the red. And the battles went on. And it all finished up. When the red got too far, or the enemy got too far into our territory, the atomic bomb would be used, or atomic rockets or whatever. And that used to be the end of the exercise. There was no training then about what we're going to do.
How long would that go then? I mean, how long would the exercise run for before you assume that...
About 5 or 6 days. That's the time which I think the Russians would have, with their vast numbers, would have got into the places where, where we would be in such a state that we couldn't hold them back. And I think the atomic bomb was the last resort.
At the time, did you think the Russians were likely to invade Western Germany? What were your ideas about the prospect?
A couple of times we thought they might. There was always that danger that they had this masked, and of course we were all trained that if they should come, what would happen? All the plans were there for the civilians to be pushed back to Ostend and whatnot, and who had cars and who didn't have cars, who would drive, and all this was all planned out for everyone to get back, and we had our own positions to go to, our battle areas where we would go to.
Were those areas close to Hola, close to the regimental base?
Well, they would be out on the training areas, or later they would go up forward. It would depend on different regiments had their positions to go to, and of course later, when the Germans had their army, where they would go to. But we didn't know much about where the Americans were doing, or the French, because they were down further south. We reckoned that the British Army was in the most vulnerable spot.
Why was that?
Well, I think the ground was easier to come from that direction through East Germany, straight through to us, where I think they're a bit more hilly and mountainous down further south, where the progress would be rather slower. I think the open plains were more or less in front of us. They could come down from Harz Mountains area, or anywhere that way, and come straight across, I suppose.
Did you see anything of the Russian army at all while you were in Germany?
No, we saw that they used to have a mission. They used to drive around with their big limousines and flags and that bit. They had permission to drive in most places around Germany, as I think the British did in their zone, I don't know, I think so. And occasionally, I think we had a cocktail party in the regiment. This was much later on, when we had about 30 Russian officers come to the regiment and had cocktails with their wives and whatnot. And of course, I remember one night we had this cocktail party. All the officers were there and wives, and we got a turnout, you know, one of these flash where everybody had to take the tanks out and get out and into that. And all these Russians were in there, in the mess. And Colonel Mike Goodhead was running at the time. And he came up to me and said, "Freddie, can you cope? We've got to go." So I was left there with, you know, the wives and food guests and Russians. You know, try to keep them entertained for a bit until all the regiments would get out and about. So they must have sort of looked, of course they knew what went on. They probably knew the plans as well as anybody else. But it was rather funny that it should happen on that particular night.
Indeed, a coincidence, or perhaps more than a coincidence?
Pardon?
Was it perhaps more than a coincidence that they were there on that night?
No. They wouldn't know. We didn't know. Nobody knew. So they'd come from brigade. Move. And even the colonel didn't know. He gets no warning. And everybody has to get in. And of course, they're timed of how long they're going to get there and how many tanks are there. You know, and so the somebody from the gate would be in the area to know if the regiment is now ready to fight. And that's what it's meant to be, that you are at 2 hours' notice, I think, to be in your position and ready to fight. And they normally then do a check to make sure that you've got all your ammunition, your tanks or petrol. Mm. It's like a complete check.
How often did this sort of thing happen, roughly?
I think probably about twice a year in that year.
Did
used to happen throughout the year, not just one regiment necessarily.
Did you exercise that? Did you practice for doing that, for crashing out and taking up position?
Well, not necessarily take that position. We'd know that from previous things, but we'd always make sure, you know, that, say, no tank went to bed glad of being full up of petrol. And I know you've still got your tanks in workshops, which have got the engine out, and that's what I'm working on.
Can't deploy those.
No. But there should only be a certain number in that condition. You can't sort of say have half a squadron like that. It's got to be, say, right, that one can go in workshops a day, one from A, one from B, one from C, and work on them. So if you are one tank short or two tanks short, that's...
Did you have spare tanks so that you could do this sort of routine maintenance without depleting the operational strength?
No.
No.
Later, they did. But I'll tell you later, I commanded a unit that held all these tanks in reserve. Each regiment should have had six. But I, later, towards the end of my career, I held a unit which had 180 tanks. And they were all reserved for Germany.
Will this be the armoured delivery squadron?
That's right.
Yes. How long did it take to do a routine maintenance work on a Centurion or a Conqueror?
Well, I think it depends on what you've been doing. If you've just come back from exercise, you know, it's going to take you 2 or 3 days to get it right. First of all, you've got to wash down, get all the mud off. Then you've got to go around, clean off all the nipples and grease them. You've got to check all your oils and top them up if necessary. That's the driver doing this. The gunner would be doing his guns, all the maintenance on that. The wireless operator would be doing his anything, but his didn't take much time, so therefore he would help the driver in cleaning down, that sort of thing. So, if the tank has been kept in good condition and not gone a week without any the driver bothering to do anything, you see, if it's kept in good condition, I mean, it shouldn't take him a good day. He could then make sure everything is 100%. See, they have to tighten the tank jacks up sometimes or take a link out, and all those sort of things take a lot of time.
Well, but when you were doing this maintenance, the routine maintenance, was this done on a basis of time or was it on mileage?
Well, you'd always do it on time. You know, when you came back from an exercise, you'd check everything and make sure. But certain things have to be done on mileage, like an oil change, a gearbox change, and all those would be done. And tank tracks would have to be changed after so many miles. That's all done, but that's all kept in the record, and at the time would say, right, tank track change.
Who kept the records? Were they kept by the individual crews, or did you keep them?
You have your own logbooks.
For each tank?
For each tank, and any modification or anything, your amount of oil you're using, and all that would be in there, and petrol. When you did certain things, certain oil changes, everything would be in there. So the troop leader would look for the troop tank commander. He should sort of keep an eye and say, oh yeah, we're due for another tank, get on and do it. But also too, it's all those books used to come in the technical academy.
So you had to check through them?
And I used to check through that they were right. And also, I used to know when tanks were, had the tracks changed, because I had to get those tracks there, and they weigh tons. You can't just sort of say, oh, here's, put those in, you know, complete. And you not only do you have to get them there, you have to then dispose of the others, you see, which involves a lift to put them on the vehicle and get them away.
Who are you dealing with those things? Was it at divisional level or brigade level or ordnance?
Which is a brigade one.
A brigade ordnance depot had the tracks and other things
well,
like that.
Well, you would put your order in for them, and then it's up to them to make sure they're there for you.
And who transported those to and fro? Was it your transport
or
their transport?
Our transport. Go to the ordnance depot and say, right, we've got this to play. A lot of it was normal common sense, like with your car, you would know when something's going to be done, and your tank was exactly the same.
It sounds like you're doing a lot of actual field work. Were there any restrictions on track mileage or anything of that sort of that time?
Not at first, but later there was. I can't remember exactly now what they were restricted to, but it was unrestricted. And I'm not sure that it came down to about 300 miles a year. But I know it's, because I think after 3,000 miles, it was 3,000 miles, the tank went back for base overhaul. I think it was three. I might be wrong. It's a long time ago.
Does that mean it had to go out of the regiment?
Go out of the regiment. You've got a replacement in. That would go to the base workshops, where it'd be stripped down and completely, more or less, rebuilt. And then back into the ADS, ready for going back to the regiment. Which, you know, when the regiment had to send a tank to workshops, a tank would come from the ADS in first-class condition, battle-worthy. That one would go back, be repaired, come into the ADS, ready to go out again.
And the ADS being the armoured delivery squadron.
That's right, yes.
So you've got a sort of rotation round.
Yeah, sometimes if the ADS was up to strength with their tank, they would go to an ordnance depot. And eventually, they would be issued to the ADS again. Replenishment service on tanks.
Doing the exercises, what was your role when you went out on an exercise?
Me?
Yeah.
Well, I used to go around to different squadrons. If there was a tank in trouble, recovery, I would then arrange with EME to recover it. That's if the ARB in the squadron couldn't cope. If that was a more or less a write-up type thing, then we'd get it back to EME, and then I would make sure it got back to the base workshops.
What sort of things would or could disable a tank to that extent?
Well, if there was a fault with the engine, that say the engine might have big end's gone or something, something big, or you might get the final drive sprocket breaks up or something like that, which would then need a heavy repair team to do it. Although later they got so that in the squadrons they could change an engine on the spot. Like
but not at this stage?
Not at this stage, no. But they got so good with our squadron fitters that apart from war, they would cope with it.
The situation now seems to be that if one part of an engine fails, you take the whole engine out, put a new one in, the tank goes off, and you work on the engine.
No, the engine goes back.
And the engine
Nobody
goes back,
works
yes.
On the engine.
Yeah, but I mean, you don't work on the engine in the tank. You swap engines.
Now they can lift them out.
Yes, exactly.
Put a replacement in if it's too bad. That engine then goes to base workshop. Yeah.
Quite. Whereas in your time, if a component failed in an engine, presumably you would work on the engine in the tank to replace.
That would be up to the fitter staff there on the job to say, well, this is beyond me. Send it back. If it's beyond the EME workshop, the main regimental workshop, then it would go further back.
But the whole tank would go back,
the whole tank.
Not the engine lifted out and taken back.
No, they wouldn't leave a tank complete immobilised like that, because it's no good to man or beast.
And you wouldn't have a new engine ready to put into
no,
it?
No.
Not
no.
A spare, no,
no
spare engine.
Have to get one up.
Yeah.
The thing is, we didn't carry spare engines. They would have to come up and face.
Another thing that I think happened quite often during the war was that tanks would cast tracks. Did that happen a lot on exercise?
Oh, yes. It depends on the going, you see. Sometimes you'd be going along, and then you might get into a marshy bit, or the driver might hit something and do a scribble, and the track would come off. Well, in lots of cases, the driver or the crew could get it back on again. But a lot of hard work, it is heavy work to do that. And if the conditions are bad, it makes it even worse, you see, because you need a flat surface to put the tank, the track out on, in order to get it to run right and then pull it over. But it is hard work. I say, weigh how much one steel thing actually weighs about 28 pounds at least, I should think, solid steel. There used to be things of 3 or 4. So you know you change the track once you've done it.
What sort of scale were the exercises?
Well, at one time they used to be sort of army size, but then they start cutting down, so they're not too divisional. And the big exercises, I think they started cutting down altogether. So you can imagine the cost. Say with one tank, I think I used to allow in my calculation, I think 4 gallons of petrol per mile for a tank. Now, I used to reckon that would take care of all the static running and the running of the tank. So I used to think, well, if they're out for 24 hours, the engine will have been running for
24 hours or so.
24 hours more or less. And I used to calculate that you'd need about 200 gallon per tank per day.
Were you responsible for that as well, for delivering fuel as technical measurement?
Each squadron had its own supply vehicles, but it was up to me to make sure that the petrol was there for them to load up. I mean, I didn't have to take it up or anything like that, but it's my responsibility to make sure the petrol was available.
Dumped.
Which, I mean, some people said, why doesn't the quartermaster do that? Well, I think the quartermaster had to do the ammunition, had to do the food, and that's it. I think petrol was a lot to look after. When you get 200 gallon per tank, that's what, 10 jerry cans.
Probably more, 20
gallons. 4.5 gallons.
Good, about 20 jerry cans, wouldn't it?
Per tank. For one squadron, say 15 tanks as they're working on there. There's a lot of jerry cans, and then you've got 3 squadrons, and also you've got to look after the petrol for the dingoes and for the B vehicles.
How many dingoes did you have?
They started running a recce troop, which I think they had about 6 dingoes in there. Around about 6. And at one time, there used to be 1 per squadron. Then you had your jeep as well. You had your water truck, the one-ton truck. And 3 lorries in the A echelon. So each one needs quite a lot of petrol.
How many vehicles did you have for petrol resupply in the field?
Well, let's see now. What used to happen, each one, say, had 3 in their A echelon, or 2 in their A echelon, and 2 in the B echelon, and they used to do a swap.
So rotating round.
That's right. And I would probably have 3 or 4 ready back to replenish those. So it was a case they would come back from the air, from right up the front, the AS, come right back to where I was, or to the echelon where these vehicles would be, change, another driver would go up, the same stuff on,